order, and we'll consider House Bill 2905 first. Justice Hung. Would you state your name, sir,
yes,
for the record, please?
My name is Thomas H. Tung. I am here in response to a letter from the chairman of this committee. I speak solely as an individual. Since I am a judge, however, I would prefer to read from my notes. I don't have copies for you at this time, but I will
prepared
for this committee.
Thank you.
My purpose is not so much to argue against the rulemaking power as it is to point out some of the questions to be considered by you in deciding whether to recommend the adoption of this bill and at this time. To begin with, as you well know, this bill proposes that the Oregon legislature would surrender to the Oregon Supreme Court the power to rewrite all of the present statutes relating to pleading practice and procedure in all civil litigation. The legislature would also surrender any responsibility that it may have to disapprove of any of the changes made by the court in the provisions of these statutes, all of which, by the terms of the bill, would become rules of court subject to repeal or change at any time by the court. By way of contrast, most previous proposals for rulemaking have reserved to the legislature the power to approve or reject the proposed rules of procedure. So far as I know, the only previous proposal under which the legislature was asked to give such a blank check to the court without reserving such control was in 1959, when a bill was introduced with almost identical provisions. That bill was tabled by this same committee. By way of further contrast, the equally important subject of criminal procedure has been submitted by the legislature to a criminal law revision commission for study and recommendations back to the legislature. This legislature decided that criminal procedure should be revised by the process of repeal or amendment of existing statutes rather than by the rulemaking process. Thus, the first question which this committee may desire to consider is whether or not there are any compelling reasons why it should surrender to the court all of its presently existing responsibility and control over procedure in civil litigation, when it apparently felt that it had such a responsibility on the equally important matter of criminal procedure. In deciding whether there are any such compelling reasons, you may desire to consider these additional questions. First, is the subject of pleading practice and procedure in civil proceedings a matter of concern only to lawyers and judges, or is it one which involves substantial matters of concern to litigants themselves as well as to the public? Is the Oregon system, as it presently exists, a failure? How bad is it? Are there groups which have any legitimate interest in this subject, which should have an opportunity to study this proposal and to make recommendations to this committee before it takes action on this bill? Is there any compelling reason why this committee must make this important decision and at this time, without waiting for recommendations by such groups? Before discussing these questions, however, I would like to discuss very briefly one of the principal arguments by proponents of this bill. In a letter dated March 15, 1973, addressed to the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, one of my esteemed colleagues said this: "In the past, there were attempts to modernize certain provisions in the code. Such efforts were sometimes blocked by the efforts of one or two lawyers. In other words, the contention is seriously made that the reason why this legislature has not approved past proposals for improvements in civil procedure is that one or two lawyers have been able to control the actions of this legislative body. It is not for me to say, of course, whether members of this legislature may or may not consider this to be a reflection upon its ability to legislate. It seems to me, however, that it is more likely that the reason for rejection of past proposals has been that the legislature thought that they have no merit. In any event, any past failures by this legislature to adopt proposal for changes in statutes relating to procedure in civil cases can hardly provide a good reason why you should now surrender all responsibility and control over these matters to the court. In that same letter, it was also stated that bills regarding civil procedure generally have no public appeal and are really only of any great interest to the bench and bar, and that the problems will be very unpolitical, unlike a substantial number of problems raised by the criminal law revision project. It may be that these problems of civil procedures are not as political as some of the problems of criminal procedure. This does not mean, however, that they are not important. Let us take a few examples. First, the matter of notice pleading and discovery. In criminal law, the legislature did not surrender to the court either the question of the extent to which a criminal is entitled to notice of the charges against him, or the related question of the extent to which both the criminal defendant and the state are entitled to engage in pretrial discovery so as to find out what evidence the other side has or what contentions it will make on the trial. Instead, the legislature reserved its right to approve or disapprove proposals on such matters, and it was also decided that any such changes should be made by statute rather than by court rule. It is my understanding that proposals by the Commission on pretrial discovery in criminal matters have been the subject of considerable discussion and debate by the legislature. These are matters of proper concern by legislators, regardless of whether some law professors and judges may favor broader pretrial discovery in criminal cases and the making of such changes by court rule rather than by statute in both criminal and civil cases. This same problem in civil cases has many of the same ingredients. Your constituents are all people who may be sued in a civil case or have a claim on which they may desire to bring a suit. Are those who are sued for an amount which may exceed their life savings entitled to have the ultimate facts alleged to support the claim set forth in a written complaint as now required, or must they pay not only their lawyers but court reporters for the expense of depositions to discover the basis of such claims? Most of the federal rules on pretrial discovery have already been adopted by statute. There is no reason why other federal discovery rules may not also be adopted by statute if and when this legislature decides that this should be done. Another example is that of class action. Although not so widespread in its application, all of your constituents are potential members of various classes. On the other hand, some of your constituents, including those who manufacture products or sell any product or service, including the financing of installment sales or the lending of money, are potential defendants in class action. Under present Oregon statute, the class suit can be brought only for an injunction to stop an unlawful practice, but not a class action for damages. Under the federal rules, such actions are permitted by court rule. Occasionally, a class action may involve thousands of persons, and some federal judges have recently expressed some disenchantment over what has happened as a result of that rule. If such class actions are desirable, no rulemaking power is required, because this legislature can accomplish that result by the removal of a single word from an existing Oregon statute on this subject. The question, however, is this: is this a problem of such a nature that you should have pause before surrendering to the proponents of rulemaking the manner in which it is resolved. These and many other subjects are presently provided for under Title II of the present Oregon Revised Laws, entitled Procedure in Actions of Law and Suits in Equity. And I invite you to take a look at that section, that chapter. Under this bill, all of these statutes, and many others as well, would become rules of court, subject to change at any time by the court, and no longer subject to control by the legislature. Indeed, this bill makes no attempt to specify all of the many statutes that would be repealed. In other words, any statute that the court by majority vote holds to be a statute, quote, relating to pleading, practice, and procedure, unquote, would be repealed and made a court rule. Title II alone includes provisions relating to the following subject, to list only a few additional examples. Limitation of action, disqualification of judges for alleged prejudice, the number and qualifications of jurors. Again, the question to be decided is whether these matters are of such importance that you should hesitate before recommending that this legislature surrender its present responsibility and control over these and many other matters of equal importance. The next question I would suggest is this: is the present Oregon system a failure? How bad is it? In considering this question, it is important to recognize that the proposal to confer the rulemaking power on the court would not only involve a drastic transfer of power from the legislature to the court, but would also involve a drastic change in our present judicial system and in our present concept of the proper role of the courts and judges in Oregon. This may at first appear to be an extreme statement, but let me explain. The present judicial system in Oregon is based upon concepts of judicial restraint and balance of power. This is the very antithesis of the judicial system proposed by those who would advocate the rulemaking power, as exemplified by the federal rules of civil procedure, which have been adopted by practically all states in which the rulemaking power has been conferred upon the court. Under existing statutes and constitutional provisions, the present Oregon judicial system includes these basic features. Under a present Oregon statute adopted as recently as 1959, the Oregon Supreme Court, as a court, has general administrative authority and supervision over the courts of this state. In some other states, this supervisory function is vested entirely in the Chief Justice. Other members of such courts do not share in that responsibility, but are pretty much relegated to the writing of opinions, like you might say, drones in the hive of the queen bee. Next, the selection, disqualification, and removal of judges. In Oregon, all judges must be elected by the people and must run for re-election every 6 years. In many other states, judges are either appointed for life or appointed under a so-called Missouri plan. Also in Oregon, a party has a right to disqualify for prejudice a judge from sitting on his case. In many states and in the federal courts, this right is very limited, if not non-existent as a practical matter. And of course, Oregon has had a statutory code of both civil and criminal procedure for many years. And as recently as 1959, this legislature decided to retain control over both criminal and civil procedure and expressly declined to confer the rulemaking power on the Oregon Supreme Court. And I refer to ORS 1002, adopted in 1959. Some 26 states have conferred rulemaking power on their Supreme Courts. In practically all, if not all, of these states, this has resulted in the complete or almost complete adoption of the federal rules. The remaining 24 states, including Oregon, have, for the most part, statutory codes of civil and criminal procedure, under which state legislatures have retained their right of control. Next, I would point out that in Oregon, the powers of trial judges are much more limited than the powers of judges in states which have adopted the federal rule. Indeed, one of the principal bases underlying the federal rule is the idea that trial judges should be vested with great power. A federal judge may refuse to permit attorneys to ask questions of prospective jurors, all such questions being asked by the judge. A federal judge may comment on the evidence, that is, he may tell the jurors what witnesses should not be believed. This may not be done in Oregon. Federal trial judges sometimes go so far as to require the testimony of important expert witnesses to be limited to a copy of their written report, so as to deprive the parties of the right to examine and cross-examine live witnesses before a jury. Federal judges also have power to set aside jury verdicts, which they think are too large or too small. Oregon trial judges formerly had that power, but exercised it so freely that in 1910, the voters of Oregon adopted a constitutional amendment which provided, I quote, "No fact found tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of this state unless the court can affirmatively say that there is no evidence to support the verdict." This constitutional provision is unique. No other state has such a provision. It has been decried and bemoaned by some Oregon lawyers, law professors, and judges just as loudly as some of them now bemoan the Oregon Code of Civil Procedure. In 1962, however, the Commission for Constitutional Revision, established pursuant to action by this legislature, again considered and decided to retain these provisions of Article 7, Section 3 in the Constitution, which was proposed by that commission. To me, the adoption in 1910 by the people of Oregon of this limitation on the power of judges and the retention of that provision for over 60 years is perhaps the best evidence that the people of Oregon have deliberately chosen to limit the power of judges rather than to confer vast additional powers upon them as now proposed by the proponents of rulemaking. How bad is the present Oregon system? Professor Knutson of Lewis and Clark College, who never practiced law under the Oregon Code of Civil Procedure, has written a law review article referring to, quote, "Oregon's Jabberwocky Code of Civil Procedure." While one may agree that it may have faults and need improvement, you may desire to consider the question whether it has worked in actual practice compared with courts which operate under the federal rules. For this purpose, I would suggest these two objective tests. First, the comparative extent of delays in litigation, and next, the comparative expense to litigants. In most states, one of the principal reasons for the adoption of the federal rules was that the courts were so far behind, resulting in great delays in litigation. Proponents of the federal rules say that at the present time in Oregon, lawyers and courts devote much time to matters of pleading. If this is true, one would expect the Oregon courts to be behind in their dockets, and the civil litigation in Oregon would take longer than in courts with the federal rules. This is simply not true. On the contrary, the Oregon courts function with less delay than those of perhaps any state. Both the Oregon Supreme Court and Court of Appeals are current in their dockets. The Circuit Court in Portland has made a record which is probably unequaled by any other large American city. It is now trying civil cases within 4 or 5 months after filing, and is trying criminal cases within an average of 41 days or 6 months after arrest, not indictment. This primary reason for the adoption of federal rules in other states simply does not exist in Oregon. The proponents of the federal rules tell you the hours for which they must charge clients fees in court appearances on motions and demurs. They do not tell you of the hours for which clients must be charged for the more extensive discovery procedures under the federal rules, or in pretrial conferences or other appearances in federal courts prior to trial. You may hear testimony from Oregon lawyers on this matter. The expense to clients is important. Since becoming a member of the court, my opportunities for comparison are more limited. To me, however, it is significant that we still get a substantial number of appeals involving $2,000 or $3,000. This is a continuing indication to me that the expense of litigation of a civil case in the Oregon courts must not be too prohibitive as compared with litigation in the federal courts. Thus, on an overall basis, my impression is that while the Oregon system may be a jabberwocky system to the orderly mind of a law professor who has never practiced under it, and while the Oregon system may not be perfect, it has performed very well, probably better than under a court system in any state which has gone the rulemaking route. Moreover, the Oregon system has in Article 7, Section 3, a unique distinction as the result of constitutional amendment by the people of Oregon, which to me is completely inconsistent with the very idea that this legislature should surrender to the court all of its present responsibility and control over existing procedure in civil litigation. The next question I would suggest that you may desire to consider is, are there any groups that have such an interest in the proposal of House Bill 2905 to be entitled to consultation prior to its adoption? Now, obviously, the two groups most directly concerned are trial judges and trial lawyers. They are the ones who would be required to change their present practices and learn new procedures. All Oregon trial judges are members of the Oregon Judicial Conference. One of its functions by statute is to study and make recommendations on matters of practice and procedure. House Bill 2905 expressly provides that this judicial conference of judges be consulted by the Oregon Supreme Court in the preparation of the proposed new rules of procedure. Accordingly, this committee may be interested in the views of the judicial conference on this subject. The chairman of the judicial conference is the Chief Justice. It also has an executive committee with power to act on its behalf between its annual meetings. At the last meeting of that executive committee on May 11th, this bill was called to its attention by Judge Crookham, a trial judge. At that meeting, by a vote of 5-1, with two members absent and the Chief Justice dissenting, the court administrator, Mr. Hicks, was instructed by the executive committee of the judicial conference to direct a request to this committee that it defer further consideration of this bill until after the judicial conference on June 7th, at which time it is on the agenda of that conference for discussion. It was the sense of the executive committee that this bill is of such importance to all Oregon judges that all of them have a legitimate interest in this matter, so as to make it reasonable to request as a matter of fair and reasonable consideration, responsible consideration of this proposal, that the judges of Oregon have an opportunity to consider this proposal and to make known to this committee their views upon it before it is considered further. I understand from Judge Crookham that the Executive Committee of the Circuit Judges Association has adopted a similar resolution.
Questions?
I have a little more, if I may, Senator. And while I'm speaking of the position of judges on this bill and their concern over its provisions, I would like to set the record straight on one other matter. I speak of appearances made before the House Judiciary Committee on behalf of this bill by one of my colleagues on the Supreme Court and by the Court Administrator. This may help to explain why the House Judiciary Committee voted in favor of this bill. At that hearing, no opponents of this bill appeared. Whether any of them had notice of it, I do not know. In any event, those who did appear in support of the bill included one member of the Oregon Supreme Court and the Court Administrator. According to the committee minutes, they both stated that they appeared not only individually, but on behalf of the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. They also stated to the committee, according to its minutes, that all members of the Oregon Supreme Court supported this bill, or at least that none opposed it. So far as I know, however, and according to the agenda of the conference meetings of the court, this bill has never been discussed at any conference meeting of the court. It has never, as a court, considered this bill or what position should be taken by the court with reference to it. The other group with the greatest legitimate interest in this subject, of course, are the Oregon trial lawyers, and no doubt you'll hear from them later today. The final question is this: is there an emergency at this particular time of such urgency as to require this session of the legislature to act immediately and without the benefit of consultation with these two groups with the greatest and most legitimate interest through their responsible organizations? All I intend to say on the question of emergency is that since 1938, we have been told that unless Oregon conferred rulemaking power on its Supreme Court and adopted the federal rules, as advocated by the law professors, that we were doomed. I believe that the years since 1938 have proved the falsity of that forecast. Instead of falling behind the federal courts and states which have adopted the federal rules, the Oregon judicial system has proved to be probably the best in the nation in minimizing delays in litigation. And I'm also convinced that the Oregon judicial system has been able to do so with less expense to litigants than under the federal system. In my opinion, for what it may be worth, the Oregon judicial system, including the Oregon Code of Civil Procedure, has proved in recent years that it has sufficient strength and efficiency so as to require that you as legislators should not be stampeded by this cry of emergency, but should hesitate before you make such a drastic change in this system, at least until the Oregon trial judges and Oregon trial lawyers have had an opportunity to be heard on this important matter through their responsible organization. That's
thank you. Questions of Justice Tone. Senator Smith.
Justice Tone, you mentioned that 26 states now have the rulemaking authority within the Supreme Court, and that most of those 26 states have indeed gone to the federal rules. How many have not gone, and do they have, what, a combination of?
My understanding, Senator Smith, is that 26 have the federal rules. We were told, I was talking to the chief the other day, and he said that practically all of them have the entire federal rule. Some of them have tried to adopt some, but not all, but they found that if you adopt most of them, you better have them all. The other 24 states mostly have codes of civil procedure, such as in Oregon. There are two or three southern states that have a common law system of pleading practice. That's my understanding. Professor Newsom, of course, has all the facts and figures on that.
Well, then, following the question, of course, the next point, I think, which you made is that should rulemaking authority be given to the Supreme Court, then indeed you foresee the federal rules being adopted by the Supreme Court.
Well, I do not necessarily foresee that. In Montana, I think there are really two questions. One, is the practice under the federal rules better than under Oregon practice? By the test of expense and delay. Second, if so, what is the manner in which those rules should be adopted, and how should the legislature proceed? In some states, such as Montana, the entire process was done by amendment to statute. In most states, as I understand it, the legislatures have retained the power to approve or disapprove all or any part of the rules proposed after they have been prepared. Under this bill, however, all of the present procedural statutes would become rules of court, subject to change by the court, and the legislature would retain no power to disapprove. So you've got both the question going to the merits and the question of how it should be done and to what extent the legislature should retain control. And then there's the final question. is it timely now? Is this the change so important that there should be some further consideration of the trial judge's views, the lawyer's views? Is it better if something like this, if it is to be made, come after a consensus has been reached?
Further questions? Senator Ivers.
Justice, prior to your appointment to the Supreme Court, you were the ex-practicing law for several years.
Yes. I'm the most recent judge from practice. Perhaps that's why I disagree with some of my colleagues.
In that practice, of course, you practice under, in the federal court, under the federal procedure.
Yes.
And the state, have you noticed any undue or greater delay in the Oregon system as against what you had to face in the federal court?
This is what I've been trying to say, not very effectively. I think lawyers can speak more to that point and present impressions. But my impression was that you waste more time in discovery and pretrial conferences going up for call, that many times you could try the case three times in the time that you spend in these federal procedures. And if you have a client that is an individual or a small businessman with limited resources, you can't bill him for your time. If you have a corporation with a client, this is a double advantage. Number one, you can charge more your client for your time, and you also can make it awful tough on your opponents when you serve these federal documents on it, 100 written interrogatories.
Thank you.
Senator John Burns.
Justice Tung, this would give the Supreme Court the authority to promulgate rules for the Court of Appeals, too, right?
It says any court.
Any court, and that would include the Court of Appeals. Okay. Going to the very first statute in the first volume of ORS.
Is that 102?
Yeah, to which you made reference.
Yes. The adopted in 1959,
yes.
The court expressly excluded rulemaking.
Okay. Well, we have had trouble from time to time with some of the courts in the state. I remember a court who has a judge who has since retired who took him from May 29th to October 15th to rule on a demur from the one. And we have had some problems of a similar nature. Has the court, pursuant to this statute, since 1959, endeavored to exert authority and supervision over those kinds of instances?
I think, Senator, that of course, this is the chief. Actually, the chief justice is the one that performs this function. He is the one that studies the reports from the various judges. There are detailed reports made periodically by all circuit judges showing the number of cases under advisement, how long they've been under advisement, and the statistics are kept on those subjects. Now, the court. As the court is not consulted by the Chief Justice on these matters, this also involves a question that sometimes will arise under the Judicial Fitness Commission, of which I was the first chairman.
I know that.
And we would occasionally have complaints of judges that were dilatory or judges that were irascible. And while the bill in its provisions wouldn't make it possible to remove a judge under those circumstances, we found that served a useful function in making it possible for us to contact that judge
and
call to his attention.
Well, Madam Chairman, that's my point, and I think you're uniquely qualified to respond to that because you were the first chairman of the commission and now you're on the court. And I want to know the line of distinction between the provisions of 002 and the mandate that the court has general administrative authority and supervision over the courts. What's the line of distinction between that and where the conduct of the judge with respect to administrative matters falls within the purview of the Judicial Fitness Commission? And I ask that question because the proponents of the bill have suggested to the committee that if we pass this bill, it will enable the Supreme Court to adopt rules which would equalize the caseload, make some of these fellows work harder, and this is a completely apart from the federal rules issue.
Well, Senator, it seems to me that that is a problem that's quite separate and distinct from the rules of procedure. I think it's frank to say that some judges have some concern over this, but I don't think it's a matter of procedure. The Chief Justice at the present time, if the judge in a particular county is getting behind on his docket, will send another judge in or talk with him about it. To what extent the Chief Justice individually talks with these with judges, I don't know. I can't answer the question because actually the Chief Justice pretty much does that himself individually.
Further questions of Justice Thomas?
I just have one more, Madam Chair.
Senator Smith.
Justice Thomas, should this bill pass, would it preclude the legislature from ever making decisions regarding amending a rule by the Supreme Court that was adopted?
Well, I don't know that I can answer that question or whether I should, because that question might come before the court. Certainly no provision is made in the bill for a reservation of control by the legislature. There's also the contention, of course, that the Supreme Court of any state, as a matter of its inherent power as a separate branch of government, can make rules, and that the legislature has no power to overrule any court rule that the Supreme Court of the state may make, and that would include some in this area. But I can't answer the question.
Well,
just to raise a point, Madam Chairman, to follow this through. One of the arguments held for the passage of this bill is the argument that each year the legislature would not have to amend continually civil law, at least now, and no doubt criminal as well, even after the criminal code has passed. That we would not, and lawyers would not have to continue to come down and lobby, and judges would not have to continually be concerned, and the legislators would no longer be concerned. But of course, if this bill did not preclude the legislature from amending rules, that is not a good argument. If it does preclude the legislature from making any decisions, then I think the question is more serious, because then we have the matters of, I assume, the Supreme Court making determinations regarding reasonable fees for lawyers, and then there are some lawyers who are going to be making decisions on reasonable salaries for judges. I assume that's all part of the rulemaking procedure. Would that be true or not?
Well, at the present time, the only control that the court has over attorneys' fees are in cases in which a statute or contract is provided that an attorney is entitled to a fee, that the court set the fee and determine its reasons. That is done now. I don't anticipate any change in that under what would be proposed by this bill.
Could be changed, however, if the Supreme Court had complete rulemaking authority.
Yes, I suppose that would be.
Further questions? Senator White.
Justice Tongue, I'm not as familiar as I'd like to be with the procedures and at the highest level of the courts. Who has the responsibility today, other than a lawyer the bar or the legislature of suggesting amendments that would have changed the rules for procedure?
Well, I would say that there are two groups, Senator Hoyt. By the statute that Senator Burns called attention to, I think our court has the responsibility to do that. I can't say that it has discharged that responsibility, at least in this area, because the court, as a court, has never considered this bill. The other body that by statute has that responsibility is the Judicial Conference of Judges, which meets annually and will meet in 3 weeks.
That's not really a very efficient, speedy means of achieving the goal, is it?
No. There was a judicial council that was established by the legislature and abolished by the legislature 2 years ago.
Now, I'm trying to leave the point of whether, if this were bill were to pass with restrictions of such as legislative approval or something of that sort, is it any likelihood that your body would move more rapidly than what's happened in the past in modernization or improvements, assuming they're needed?
I just don't know, Senator Hoyt. Certainly, if this bill were passed, our court would have to spend immediately a great deal of time on this that a lot of us would rather spend trying to keep up with our caseload. We would simply have to do it, and it would mean that it would have to be a set of rules prepared, and the decision would have to be made whether those rules would replace completely our present code as under the federal rules, or simply seek to make piecemeal change.
The bill, Madam Chairman, the bill itself doesn't really have force you to make a lot of changes all in a hurry, does it?
There's no requirement, as I understand, that the court shall return reported by any specified date. We've been considering one rule change procedure within our domain, and it's taken a long while for this for one. I don't know how quickly the court could function in this area.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
May I be excused?
Yes, surely.
Could we have a copy of the remarks? Or at least
Justice Tung,
would
you send over to us a copy of your remarks? I'd like the committee to know that each one of the justices was invited to appear today before the committee. Mr. Salton?
Senator Brown, member of the committee. Pricing lawyer in Eugene, Oregon. I'm appearing on my own behalf individually. I testify in favor of the proposed bill. I do so because I believe that this bill presents for us the best opportunity to bring up to date and currently our means of using the court's machinery. I look at the rules of this state in an objective fashion, that they are in fact rules for lawyers to operate with to present their clients' cases timely and efficiently. As a practical matter, there are too many archaic provisions of our rules that I think must be updated and brought up to date. It's long past due, I think, that the result has been accomplished. Litigants lose rights in court because of complicated procedures. The techniques ought to be simplified. They should be understood by litigants as well as lawyers, and comprehended as such and made usable. I like the federal rules. The federal rules make sense. They've been in practice a long time. The courts have construed these rules. They mean something to all of us. To plead a case in this state for a lawyer is indeed a challenge. You have to be a law school graduate, preferably of this state, to really know what our rules are so you can form your case within those rules. to challenge everybody to try and present a case that you are in court and you'll stay there. We spend our money Monday mornings in Lane County, where I come from, in answering to calls. Justice Tung says that this speeds up the practice. We spend much of our time answering motions to make more definite and certain, motions to enlarge time, motions to strike, dilatory pleadings. These are passed upon sometimes with rapidity by the court. In other cases, most counties, large amounts of time are expended on useless and timeless procedures. In framing a complaint in this state, I think it's a challenge because the code provisions are indeed archaic. You have a cause of action that sounds in contract. You have to fit your case within the category of contract. If you want to sound your case in tort, you must limit your pleadings in tort. If you want to have a sound in tort and contract in the same complaint, you simply can't do it. You have to file two causes of action, two different complaints. Joiners of parties, joiners of causes of action under our code are indeed complicated and complex.
We passed a law to change that.
Beg pardon?
We passed a bill to change that.
We have presented through the state bar, I think this year, committee on which I'm a member of the practice and procedure, some 13 bills to this legislature. And in the last years, I think we presented 14 or 15 measures to sort of clean house or attempt to bring up to date some of the statutes. Specifically, if you want to join law and equity, you can't do it. If you want to put it in simple terms, if you have a client who is a stockbroker in the commodity transactions, perhaps his commodity account is short, and he also has a stock account that has a portfolio of stocks that is in a good sound position. If he suddenly loses a lot of money, and perhaps in simple terms, he's called upon to make up that money is in his commodity account. He doesn't do so. The account is then reduced to a point where the broker then sells his stock to his account. Perhaps it forces him into a long-term position on the stocks. He doesn't want a long-term capital gain on the stocks. He doesn't want a short-term position on his long, on the commodities. Do you want to join in a one litigation piece to sue that stock company or the broker? You cannot do so in equity and in law. It's an impossibility. It will take probably at least two actions to do so. You may want to file a count to rescind. You may want to file a count to make them specifically do something in a case. You may want to sue them for the breach of the contract. Also, the mental distress that may have caused you by their closing out your account and putting you in a bad tax picture or otherwise. There are cases throughout the books where we have difficulty, and even the simple joinder of causes of action, whether they sound a warranty or tort or negligence, and that you must have the cause of action affect all the parties equally. And this, of course, is a rigid impossibility. We've updated some of our procedural rules with respect to discovery techniques. We're coming current in that area of the law. It's the one highlight in the Oregon Code that we can now take depositions and that we can notice and we can discover and use some of the techniques that have been so well known in the federal courts. We cannot, up to date, use the interrogatory section because they're not effective at times. Whether you like request permission or whether you like interrogatories, they're still useful tools for discovering who the witness is in a given case are. They're most helpful in determining the facts. Law actions today are simple transactions for the discovery of the truth and for moving the litigation along. The tools in the federal court are much more effective. Whether you like summary or judgment or not, this does not have to be enacted as part of this rule. I don't even think the summary judgment is a federal rule. I think it's part of the statute rather than the rulemaking process. We don't have summary judgment. We don't have the right to join in legal cross complaints. All the persons who may be affected by a cause of action. If the plaintiff sues you and you want to return that action, and perhaps there's another party that wants to be brought in, you can't do it. If you are sued, for example, put it in everyday terms, by a retailer of merchandise, you because the account is overdue. You haven't paid it because you don't like the merchandise. It's defective. You want to cross-claim back and bring in the manufacturer. You cannot really do this. The manufacturer is guilty of warranty in the case. You cannot do this under our statute. The person that should pay the bill isn't in court before the court. I don't see the fear that lawyers and my associates of the bar have seen over the years. I've been to many bar meetings where the federal rules have been discussed and where they've been talked of with horror, but I don't see that horror. I look at the federal rules as ways to join causes of action where people have common interest in litigation, common interest in the law, common interest in the subject at hand. I don't see the point of all this the technicalities that we must learn to bring our litigants before the court and keep them in court. The real person that becomes injured in these cases is not the lawyer, it's the litigant. If he has a lawyer who's not familiar with the Oregon rules, he could well be in trouble in his litigation. Time isn't the only essence of litigation or the only factor. It's what the true and accurate result should be for the litigants involved. They must have the day in court in techniques that they understand. I don't have to cite the cases in this court, Thick versus Thick, or those cases where the common interest problem has been brought by three litigants with the same basic cause of action, but couldn't do it because they weren't affected equally by the cause of action. They couldn't all three sue in the same case. That was the alienation of affection case. The children wanted to bring their action forward on behalf of all. They could not do so. There again, we have to have three cases involved. The requirement of verification of pleadings, the idea of the old rigid type of code pleadings in assumption, pleadings in quantum merit, pleadings in express contract, all going back to the old common law. What is there so beautiful and so blessed about the common law that has to be carried on into eternity? Why don't we bring up these techniques so we can have our day in court with simplicity and understanding? So we can join in one case with contract in court. What difference does it make in terms of contract or in court? This is legal language, and I know I talk to lawyers, I talk to people who are zealous at this table. But I know that the main objective of all is to accomplish the desired result in the case, not by technicality or by some archaic rule. I don't fear the court. The court can make adequate rules. They can adopt in total or by reference the entire federal rules if they do so. We don't find it difficult to practice in California, or Washington, or Arizona, or Nevada, simply because they have a similarity to federal rules. This is not awkward for us at all. I think that this is long overdue. Perhaps 100 years of the old Dean Code is enough for all of us. We have to move along, move forward. Thank you.
Questions, Mr. Sahlstrom?
Mr. Sahlstrom, would you feel comfortable having relegating voir dire to the court?
I don't think that I'm uncomfortable with that. I don't think that today's voir dire requires all that. I like to do a lot of voir dire myself. There's some courts, even under our state practice, that don't allow lawyers to go into extensive voir dire. I think lawyers abuse voir dire. I think they make fools of themselves by asking experienced jurors in court time and time again the same old routine questions that they should know the answer to. They have to get down to the heart of the issue. Even in federal court, you can ask the federal judge to ask the fellow jurors on that panel specific questions. And you don't have to ask questions that embarrass anybody. All a lawyer wants to do in the voir dire is to relate with that juror, communicate with that juror, tell him what his cause of action is about, and get his feelings about it.
So you don't have any difficulty in relegating that to the court, particularly in the counties around the state where you might not know the people, or you might be a stranger and you would want to establish some rapport with the individual jurors.
I like to have the opportunity of doing that, and in most of the counties why we are still permitted to do that. I don't find a real handicap, however, and I think as time goes on, Senator Burns, you'll find that even in our courts, the practice will be curtailed somewhat.
Well,
because 4 years abuse on the court.
It is, no question. Well, I have one other question, Madam Chairman, and that is, I'm have generally been an advocate of the of adopting the federal rules, but I have some difficulty in going to notice pleading in district court cases, which is going to absolutely require discovery in order to find out what it's all about. Whereas now, you might defend those cases standing on your head and not waste the time and expense of deposition and all that kind of thing. Now, how are you going to practically handle the little cases under notice pleading without going into the expense of discovery which the case can't justify?
I was taking a classical case down here that you could well plead a case in the district court on a contract matter without any difficulty under notice pleading, simply stating what your cause of action is with the contract, what the contract was. You don't have to rely on fancy old words like assumption, debt, and quantum merit, and all those
niceties
of common law. I think you still have your day in the district court. We're talking about lesser jurisdictions anyway, and a smaller dollar amount. But that's really the people's court, and that's where they want to have their day, and that's where they want to be heard.
But do you think
they want to be heard in special legal terminology that's so complicated that perhaps you can't understand?
Well, I'll go along with that, but do you think that you can defend those cases without going to the expense of discovery if you go to notice pleading?
I think you can defend them if you have to make a deposition.
That's going to cost you more money.
That'll cost you.
Now you 95% of those cases you don't have to.
Most of them deserve it. That kind of expenditure and money in the district court. Most of them deserve that kind of treatment. And most of them aren't of the category that require a lot of real clarification anyway, as far as I'm concerned. If the person says on July 4th, 1973, you were negligent and that you drove your car across the street in the wrong lane, I think we can frame that even in district court where people can understand and comprehend it.
Further questions? Senator White.
You listed a rather impressive list of deficiencies in the present procedures. I've been in the legislature for 15 years now, and I've, by and large, supported bar recommendations. I'm kind of shocked to think that you've been there where you've been there that long and have not proposed more improvements in this that I would probably support. Now, who's wrong, you or me?
I don't think that you're wrong, Senator, and I'm not wrong. I don't think your son's wrong. He practices law in Lane County, too. But I think more of us have to do more in the bar to try and update the code. But we're sort of hamstrung. We have a session every 2 years, and lawyers work together on a committee for an entire year, and we make a lot of bills that we submit to the state bar, and then they're approved, and they come back over here, and some of those bills pass, and some don't pass. We appear at this committee, and one in the Senate committee, and one in the House committee. We do our best to try and bring this code along. It shouldn't have to be done that way. The rulemaking process is such that delegated to the Supreme Court can be done with clarity once and for all. It doesn't require a lot of amendments to be done, too. Once you have the rules adopted down here, as we have in the federal courts and federal rules, they can be handled rather well.
Well, just one further question. I don't want to get into a wrestling match, but someone really, your answer doesn't quite satisfy me. The bar apparently is in disagreement. This is not the first time similar bills have been before a legislator, which I'm a member. It would appear that the Supreme Court is not in total agreement. Now, I'm just wondering who should be the referee. It seems like maybe that although I have been inclined to support your position, as I hear it today, I think maybe the legislature is the legitimate referee and ought to continue. I'd like to respond to that question.
Who should be the referee? Is it a delegation of powers from this body to the court? Should the court be the referee as the rules, or should the bar, or should the legislature? I think the court should be the one that should determine what its own rules are for the carrying out of the litigation for its litigants, not the legislature. I think we're out of our bag, so to speak, by working this area. This might offend you, Senator, but as far as I'm concerned,
I just want to do
in all branches to you, the rulemaking power should be with the court. It should never have been with this body in the first place. But it's been over here a long time. So it's our obligation, it's the court's obligation to
we should give it to the court, and the court should assume the obligation, should do it, and help them move the business of the law practice on its way.
Now, just to be sure I understand you, sir, I'm gathering that you want the Supreme Court to have this authority and responsibility at the expense of the majority of the bar. You're really kind of saying that, aren't you?
At the expense of the majority?
Yes.
I'm not sure what the majority is today, what we're taking on it. I don't know how it'd be. The personnel on the federal bench has changed much in the last few years. The federal bench is a different bench than a lot of a few years ago. It's a tremendous group of people on the federal bench today. How the rules are carried out often affects the bar decision, I think. I think the rules today, if we're put to the vote, I don't know how it comes out. But no matter how it comes out, if it's a majority one way or the other, that doesn't necessarily mean that's right or wrong. What the rules really are, we have to work every day to make sure the people that have their litigation before the court. It's the court's obligation to make the rules. It's the court's obligation to see the rules fit today's times so that they can move along the litigation. It's their responsibility. I hope I answered your question.
Further questions of Mr. Solstrom? Thank you, Mr. Solstrom.
Thanks, Senator.
I would like to advise people who have signed up that the proponents, and there are six of them, and six more, will be given until 2:30, and you might adjust your time according to that schedule. The opponents will be given until 10 minutes of 3, and there are six of those, and at 10 minutes of 3, we will turn to Senate Bill 10 and hear Judge Lewis. Mr. Mueller.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Richard Mueller. I'm a lawyer and I practice law in Portland, Oregon. Speaking here as an individual, a little bit of ancient history. When I came to this state from law school up in the state of Washington, it was from a experience that we just had up there. Washington did in 1960 what this legislature is being asked to do today. I heard much the same arguments advanced by the lawyers in Washington that I heard Justice Tongue advance here. Parade of horribles. The courts were going to be overworked. There was going to be a great deal of expense for small litigants, and all good types of questions about whether we ought to do something. Well, their system, of course, was like ours. It had started in 1848, which is where ours started, and there hadn't been much improvement since then, except on a piecemeal basis. Well, we
56.
No, 1848.
Is that when ours started?
Yes. We asked you this year, Senator, to come up to 1852 down in the House, and I think they're going to do it. But Joinder, that brings us up to the change they made in New York in 1852.
Yeah, but you know, Rick, I really commend what the Bar Committee and the Bar is doing this year. And Mr. Solstrom, I think I've received 3 or 4 letters from him, and they've been constructive letters. But I have really been ashamed to be a lawyer during the 4 sessions that I've served in the legislature to see the lack of leadership the bar has provided in connection with bar bills. I've served on 3 judiciary committees, and in the last session followed the committee very closely, and time after time after time, there would be bills recommended by the bar to the committees where members of those bar committees didn't even give the legislature the courtesy of coming to testify. And it, in 67 and 69, it happened all the time. And it was abominable. And the bar is coming around. And I think that this session, there's been tremendous input. And it's good. And you've been good over the years. But the bar as a whole has really been the lousiest representative of a constituency in front of the legislature, of any significant constituency that I can think of. The workman's comp lawyers come down on the workman's comp bill. The defense lawyers come down on the defense bill. But as to bar matters generally, it's been a problem. So I don't think the legislature really is deserving of a lot of the criticism it gets from the bar when the bar itself hasn't really acted like it should.
I can't argue with you, Senator, and I hope you haven't construed my remarks as criticism of the legislature. They were not so intended. In 1960 in the state of Washington, the Washington Supreme Court, which had the rulemaking power, did what this bill would ask them to do. They hired a man by the name of Robert Weisenholder, who was then a professor of pleading at the University of Washington. He prepared a code which would be suitable for the state of Washington. Now, somebody keeps mentioning federal rules. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about new Oregon rules. We're talking about modern Oregon rules. Please don't get led down the garden path of federal rules. This fellow then presented a comprehensive scheme of modernization and revision which approximated the federal rules because they've been proven to work, but were not identical. They didn't have the right to comment on the evidence because that was withheld by Constitution, as it is in Oregon. They didn't have the right to voir dire, to withhold from lawyers the voir dire of the jury. And they did have a system to allow litigants to have their cases heard in court on merits, not on something that makes lawyers happy when we get up into words nobody else understands. And those of the members of the committee, I'm sure, who practice law have the experience of going into a courtroom, trying a case, coming out, and having your client say, "What happened?" It happens all the time with our present system. Or you go up and you get a decision out of the Supreme Court and you're faced with the embarrassing situation of telling your client, "Well, I'm sorry, but it wasn't decided on the merits. They never got to that. They decided it on a point of pleading." And then you explain about how back in 1066, why this wonderful rule was established in the common law, and this is what our card is following. Well, I think the legislature and the bar, and I'll accept Senator Burns' criticism because I think it's well put, bar owes it to the public, the state of Oregon, come up with a system that will allow litigants to have their day in court on the merits and understand what's going on. And I respectfully suggest that our Supreme Court can be trusted to come up with a system for Oregon which will do this. I saw it happen in the state of Washington. I go up there from time to time and try cases with their system. I know it works. The little litigant is not moneyed out of court because they use common sense up there, as I'm sure we will here in Oregon, so that in the district court case, their comparable system, there is a system for cheap, quick determination. Up there, they call it an interrogatory. Well, when you want to find out about the other guy's case, you just write him a bunch of questions. And money controls on both sides, and he answers the questions, and you know what the case is all about. We're not talking about expensive depositions. Also, you've got a device for abuse. If you have a wealthy client on one side and a poor client on the other, the wealthy client decides to bomb you out with depositions and interrogatories and all of the kinds of things, which, by the way, are presently you go to the court and you ask for a protective order. Any system can be abused. Our present system, I suggest respectfully to you, is abused by motions for this, motions for that, motions for the other thing, dilatory practice. Sure, you can abuse a modern system too. Again, if you trust your courts not to let the abuser get away with it, you'll be about the same place and you'll have the advantage of a system that's part of the 20th century. Our system now is not, and which the public will understand, and I think the people of Oregon will be grateful to you if you give them this kind of a system.
they'll understand how justice works in this state.
Senator Smith.
Oh, Chairman. Most of the issues which I've been familiar with coming from the bar have been issues that have been either before bar committee or recommended by the Bar Association, and they come in to the legislature with certain amendments. As I understand it, this question has never been before the bar officially, nor has the bar taken an official position. Why is that?
All right, let me be perfectly candid with you, sir.
We don't have enough votes.
In 1962, the issue was raised by me in the Pleading Practice and Procedure Committee of the Oregon Bar, asking why do we trouble the legislature every year with trying to improve our system? Why don't we just go in and say, gentlemen, here's the way to do it. I was told by older and wiser men than I that we didn't have the votes in the legislature, it was a political impossibility, and forget it, boy. And we keep trying year after year, and here we are. 12 years later.
Then what you're saying, you're a rump group of the bar testifying on your own behalf on a question that the bar has not or cannot come to grips with as a majority position.
I don't think that's true today, simply because the issue was not raised at the last general meeting. I will say that the composition of this Pleading Practice and Proceeding Committee is supposed to be representative. And the last time I sat on it, which was a year ago, the overwhelming majority was in favor of this position. When I started in the early 60s, they were against it. It's been this change. I suspect that if a vote were taken, the bar as a whole, they'd be urging. I also suggest that you take a look at the age group of the people who are testifying here today and whether they're for or against.
Question.
Gee, I just lost my vote.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller.
You're young in spirit.
Professor Knudsen.
Yes, the bottom of the office.
May I at this time say to those persons who came on bills other than 2905 or Senate Bill 10, that we will not reach them today. I apologize. I know many of you have come a long distance, and I don't wish to keep you if you prefer to leave. We will hold other hearings on the bills, and you will be notified. Go ahead.
Madam Chairman, thank you for taking me out of order, and I appreciate my colleagues allowing me to take some priority here. Although it probably isn't justified. I did leave an examination, and that's why I was so late, so please excuse me. If I had known that Mr. Justice Tongue was number one on the list, I would have done both heaven and hell to get here on time, because I have argued many cases in the appellate courts, and I have been against Mr. Justice Tongue at the law school on matters, and I know that he is a supreme advocate. He took my name in vain, and I think that a due process requires me to make some reply. But before I get to that, he did say, how bad is it? Well, I think terrible, in plain English, terrible. Mr. Justice Traynor, who is possibly the greatest judge on the Supreme Court in the United States of a state, California Supreme Court, took the position that law professors could say things that lawyers couldn't, although I see some colleagues here who have said it straight, like it is. We who are professors, since we don't appear before these judges, not that they would ever take any kind of punitive action against us, nevertheless, there is a kind of feeling that we can speak more freely. How bad is it? I wrote a letter to the governor as the chief executive officer after I finished writing my article. And I said, as a man, I was very proud of being the chief executive officer of one of the most progressive states in the union. But being a non-lawyer, you don't recognize the fact that you're in the worst five states, probably, as far as procedure. Mr. Justice Tongue mentioned 26 states. I understand from Mr. Barbie Lyon that the number now is 31 states have adopted rulemaking power and basically adopted the federal rules. Although, as Mr. Mueller said, we don't have to adopt the federal rules or any other kinds
kind of rule similar to them if we should not want to, if this bill should be adopted. But Mr. Justice Tung, so let's say there are 31 states. Of them, about 14 in the last 10 or 12 years. Now, I think this indicates something. After all, when Carl Llewellyn, who taught at Columbia University, wrote the UCC, my other professors used to make fun of him because Llewellyn was one of the greatest minds in America. They say, how many states have adopted it? None.
That's a bitter subject in
all right.
This committee.
I'll move on. The point is that it took a long time, but now I think almost every state in the union has adopted it. The federal rules were slow in coming. They were adopted in 1938 by the federal courts. And little by little, the states got on the bandwagon. And now we have 31 states, and about 5 states of the code states have adopted the content of the federal rules. So we really have approximately 36 states out of the union, out of 50 states, leaving 14. Of that 14, I think we have 3 better left unsaid, Alabama, states like that, which have the common law pleading, and I would hope we would never go back to that, although we are not even a code state, as I point out in my article. We are someplace between the common law and the codes, which many people in this state don't recognize, because the paramount advance in the code of 1848 was the union of law and equity. This state is one of the few left in the United States that has law and equity separate. England, which was responsible for the separation of law and equity in 1873, corrected it 100 years ago this year. Many other states have changed it and do not have this curious dichotomy, but we still have it. If you go into equity, don't bring in a legal matter, and so on. Mr. Justice Tung said Bill Knutson has not practiced in this state. Bill Knutson practiced 19 years. He's not an Ivy Tower professor. Every Monday morning for 3 years in the federal courts in Phoenix, I was on the motion calendar, and I have never practiced in a code state. In New York, which is a code state, I was a corporation lawyer in the doing my work in my own office. But I submit that a doctor can recognize cancer if he goes to South America, even if he comes from Oregon or New York. I submit that an engineer who builds bridges, if he goes to Thailand or London, knows what the stresses and strains are. And I submit to you that I know the difference between a good code and a bad code. And I think that Mr. Justice Tung, with all due respect for him, was setting up a straw man there. And I submit to you that this is a very, very poor system that we have now. In fact, the Supreme Court of Oregon about a year ago said the joinder provisions of the code here serve no useful purpose. And as I recall, it was a 7-0 unanimous decision, and I didn't see any statement in dissent by Mr. Justice Tung that we should keep our antiquated joinder provision. Justice Goodwin wrote an article, Code Pleading in Oregon in the 21st Century. Mr. Justice Goodwin is probably the top judge in this state, since he's on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He and Judge Kilkenny, and Judge Kilkenny is retired. He took the position that it's about time that we adopted something like the federal rules in this state. So, Mr. Justice Tung, we all know of that play, the majority of one. I think he's in a minority of one. I don't know what the court has, how it's voted. Apparently it hasn't voted, but the last time I was here before the House, Mr. Justice O'Connell sent a surrogate over, if that's not a dirty word these days, and Mr. Arnold Denneke, Mr. Justice Denneke, testified himself. There were two men who were making themselves heard, and apparently they couldn't be here today. I would ask Mr. Justice Tung this: how many top trial judges, civil procedure professors, and top trial lawyers throughout the entire nation would agree with him? And I submit to you that you couldn't put him on the fingers of one hand. On the fingers of one hand. When I wrote my article, I went through the books, I was looking for somebody who said the code system is better. Charles Clark, Dean of Yale Law School, later on the Chief Judge of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York, who was very instrumental in writing the federal rules, in 1928, over 40 years ago, 45 years ago, said the code doesn't work, and every trial lawyer knows the code doesn't work. And I submit to you, most of us know the code doesn't work. when you see the Pick case, for example, where three children suing the lady who took the father away from the mother had to sue three separate actions, when you see that you've got a loss side and an equity side, which you seldom see in the United States today except in maybe 5 to 10 states, I submit to you that we are far behind. Mr. Mueller said 1848, if you don't mind, you're slightly in error, sir. It's 1862. We were the second wave of states to adopt the code, which it was enacted in New York State in 1848. Oregon was the second wave following California. And we are basically an 1862 state. Now, before I came here, I admit I've only been here 3 years. I looked upon Oregon as a progressive state in the Union. When I got here and looked at their civil procedure, I came to the conclusion that the people didn't know what was going on. Now, much has been said about delays in litigation and expense. Mr. Salstrom said this isn't the most important thing in the world. The most important thing is justice, although none of us is in favor of delays or expense. Mr. Justice Tung, like a good advocate, neglected my empirical data that it does not cost any more. Columbia Survey, a book by someone whose name I forget, but cited in the article which I've given you, said that it does not cost any more. I almost cited a case in this article, but I didn't want to embarrass an attorney here in this state because he lost the case because he didn't engage in discovery. There's some kind of feeling that under the codes you don't need discovery. You need.
Sir, I wonder if you could finish in a couple of minutes.
You need discovery in every case. And as one gentleman said recently, you can send it out with an 8-cent stamp if you've got good interrogatories. The interrogatories in this state are of the poorest possible kind. They didn't even follow the federal rule. So I submit to you that Judge Goodwin, Judge O'Connell, Judge Denneke, and many other judges, Judge Jones in the Circuit Court of Multnomah County, and many others I've talked to, are in favor of the rulemaking power. I think we should give it to the experts, and I doubt that Mr. Justice Tung could find five people in the United States who are thoroughly familiar with both the rules and the code who would suggest that we continue with the code.
Questions of Professor Knudsen? Senator Ivers.
Professor, listening to you, I gather referred that practically everyone is for it. Now, if this is so, why hasn't the bar come forth with a recommendation?
I'm not a member of the bar here. That's another sore spot. I'm a member of three bars, but not this one. But I presume that, as Mr. Mueller said, they said you can't get it through the legislature. In 1939, the bar here was way ahead of its time. That was the 1 year after the federal rules had been adopted, and the bar here then suggested that we adopt, and here it is in Judge Goodwin's article. But somebody, I understand, one or two men in the legislature, I don't think the legislature acts this way today, where one or two men can bend the entire legislature to their will, but that's what I understand happened in 1940.
How about 1973 or 72?
I would have to defer to the prior witnesses who said that they've been told, cool it, it can't be done.
Other
I know
questions.
The young.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Carl Neal.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Carl Neal, a practicing lawyer in Portland, and I've written a letter to the chairman and members of the committee, so I shall be very brief. I've been practicing in Portland since 1959 as a former law clerk on the Supreme Court. I am presently serving as a member of the Oregon State Bar Subcommittee of the Committee on Procedure and Practice, studying rulemaking authority, and I do not appear officially on the election position, but that does account for some of my interest in this matter. Just want to touch on a couple of high points. I really think that the perhaps the most important thing to the people that are really involved in litigation is cost. How much does it cost to try particularly a small case, a $500 to $1,500 case? And when told that procedures are such that it would cost you $500 or $1,500 to try a $500 case or $1,500 case, that's impossible. It's impossible from both a plaintiff standpoint and a defense standpoint. Our firm handles in different areas both plaintiff litigation and defense litigation. I personally handle some cargo damage cases that frequently run in the range of $500 to $1,500. unfortunately, they can be filed either in the state or federal court. I always elect the federal court. Why? I'm going to get through faster. I'm going to get to my result, either settlement or trial, faster than I'm going to go. If I go in the state court, well, I may well face motions, demurs, who knows what else by the time I get this thing around. There's just no question about it. It's not faster. I would say time is comparable. But in terms of cost, it is greater if I were to file those cases there. And similarly, if I were defending a case like that, it would cost me more to defend it in the state district court or the state circuit court than in the federal court. So what I think we're talking about is savings to litigants and costs. We're also talking about saving the taxpayers and the people who pay the bills for court costs in more expeditious judicial procedure than we have now. Not necessarily in how long it takes a case to go through, but how much work and difficulty, problems, and time of judges and litigants and lawyers has to take place before you can reach a result. I'd like this final to answer a couple of questions, or try to answer a couple of questions the members of the committee raised, and respond to one point that Justice Tong made. He suggested that this committee and the legislature ought to consider carefully whether it wishes to surrender, as he put it, the power of the legislature to adopt rules rather than surrender to a court. The implication being that the legislature has no further power to do anything in this area if it does this. I don't agree with that at all. This legislature, if it adopts this bill, obviously has the power in the future to adopt another bill saying we're modifying something that the Supreme Court has done by rulemaking authority. And unlike Senator Smith, I don't think that defeats our argument for the bill. The burden in that event will be upon those, once a modern practice has been put into process and tried out, to come into this legislature and say it's no good, based on actual practice. Right now, the burden is on those who want to modernize, and the strongest hand is held by those who have a vested interest in existing archaic procedures. Finally, Senator Hoyt asked a question, who is the referee question of procedure? Is it not better that the legislature do so than the Supreme Court? My answer to that is the Supreme Court's going to do it either way. If you do it by legislation, the Supreme Court ends up interpreting the statutes, and in some cases, ignoring the statutes. Professor Newsom made reference to a recent case in McGrath versus White Motor Company, where the Supreme Court said our joiner rules are so archaic and so out of tune with the times and needs of this time that we're going to ignore them. It simply did not apply. So, to me, this means that the Supreme Court is the last referee, the last arbiter, even if we continue the system we now have, rather than go through the rulemaking authority. Thank you very much, Madam Chairman.
Questions of Mr. Neal?
Senator Smith. I was reading from your letter when I asked the question, and quoting your letter, you mentioned that there are a flood of bills that come in attempting to correct the code as it exists. My only point was that is not a very good argument, since that will not change if you and I agree that the legislature can then amend rules adopted by the Supreme Court.
I would suggest it will change. First of all, a lot of these bills you get are bar committee bills that are designed to correct a lot of little, correct this problem, correct that problem. That committee, if there are problems like that after rulemaking is adopted, it won't be coming to you. They'll be going to the Supreme Court or its advisory committee and saying, please, we need to do something. You will get some people coming.
The minorities will always be there.
Probably. But this would be true if you were passing a constitutional amendment. The fact that it's now in the Constitution you can't change it doesn't mean that some group isn't going to come back to you and say, please put another constitutional amendment or change on the ballot. No measure is ever going to deal with all the problems forever and ever.
The point is, you believe then that the legislature would have authority to enact statutes which would correct rules adopted by the Supreme Court.
I don't see how it could be any other way. I mean, the statute that gives them rulemaking authority obviously could correct anything the delegated power does with that authority by subsequent legislation.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Manley Strayer.
Madam Chairman, my name is Manley Strayer. I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon. I want to speak on behalf of Hospital 2905. As has been brought out here, this has been a controversial subject over the years. I can't give any much recent information, but I can give it a little past history. The lawyers have been divided on this subject, and generally speaking, they're divided into three categories. There are those that like things the way they are and don't want any change. Those are those who feel that our procedure in the state courts is sufficient and needs improvement. And then there's a third group of lawyers who don't go to court very often and are either don't know too much about the problems that they are, or are they it's immaterial to them. I think the lines have not changed. I see some familiar faces around here that I was arguing with 10 years ago over this same thing. Some good friends of mine. I was delighted to see Justice Tong here again. I was disappointed that he hasn't changed his mind since he became a member of the Supreme Court. I concluded long ago that our procedure, and code procedure, was sufficient, and that something had to be done to change it, and I might give the committee just a brief history of that. My interest in civil procedure reform started about 20 years ago, a little over 20 years ago, when as a chairman of the State Bar Committee on Procedure and Practice, I was delegated the job of doing something to revise our archaic procedures on depositions. And so our committee studied that problem, and that resulted in a bill to modernize our deposition procedures, which was approved by the State Bar and enacted by this legislature in 1955. And in substance, that incorporated into our state practice the deposition discovery in federal court, except for one very important factor. Bar was in disagreement in Oregon on whether they wanted to extend the scope of the deposition to the extent that it was in the federal practice, and consequently the state bar bill and the present law in Oregon is silent on the subject of the scope of deposition. As a result of that, they have nowhere near the wide range of exploratory power that the federal deposition statute has. Now, in the ensuing years, I was active in one capacity or another on the State Committee for Procedure and Practice for the next 10 or 12 years after that. During that period of time, we had a number of bills that we adopted by our committee and that the State Bar approved and which were offered in the legislature. And I'm sorry to say that virtually none of them were adopted. I regret to say that many of them passed the House but expired in this committee. And I think it speaks well of the activity of some of the opponents to change that they were able to prevent that from happening. At any rate, whatever the reasons, a legislative interim committee in the meantime had come up with a bill patterned after the federal act which passed by Congress, which delegated to the Supreme Court the rulemaking power. This legislative interim committee had proposed a bill of that sort, and the State Bar Committee on Procedure and Practice concluded that this would be the only way that we would ever have any procedural reform in this state. And as a result of that, that committee proposed a bill to give the rulemaking power to the Oregon Supreme Court. That was controversial and was debated in the bar over a period of several years. It was submitted to a written ballot of all the members of the Oregon State Bar in 1961. And I refreshed my memory recently, but I've kind of forgot the numbers. I think there were 675 in favor, 570-odd opposed, and then there were 250 or so that said they wanted further information about it. That following fall at the State Bar Convention, it was submitted to an oral vote at the State Convention, and it was defeated. As you probably know, at our State Convention, we don't have a large turnout of lawyers at the business sessions, so that probably was not representative of the sentiment of the bar. I don't know what has happened since that time. I strongly suspect that there's considerably more sentiment in favor of giving the rulemaking power than there was in those days. But it was quite clear to me at that time that the sentiment was too evenly divided in the bar to reach anything like a consensus. As far as I know, I don't know whether it has been revived since that time.
Sir, now, if you could wind up in a minute or so.
Yes, I will. Thank you. I'm on record with your committee in connection with Senate Bill 163, your class action bill, which I understand has been reported out favorably by this committee, as pointing to a large number of deficiencies which I think exist in the Oregon procedure, and is expressing my view that some flexibility in the Oregon procedure is a must if you expect that class action bill to either be workable or fair. And that is only an example of why I think that some great many changes are necessary in our civil procedure. And I think the best solution is to give it to a body, a group of men who are experts, who are skilled in that particular field, who can call upon the bar and on the trial judges to give them their help in drafting appropriate changes. Thank you.
Question, Senator Johnson.
Mr. Strayer, if you accept the premise that the adoption of the federal rules, and understand that I have said that I am inclined to go along with the adoption of it, but if you accept as a premise that adoption of the federal rules will expedite litigation, how can you explain the interminable delays and the extensive depositions and things that you are incurring right now in the Pacific Tobacco case and in the federal court?
Well, let me say first that there are things about the federal rules that I don't like, and I think you all know that from my correspondence on the class action bill. I approve in principle a class action bill, but I don't approve of some of the provisions of the federal bill, and I would hope that if the rulemaking power were given to our Supreme Court, that there would be some other features of the federal rules that it would not adopt. One of the tobacco cases that you mentioned, of course, has gone on interminably and largely because of the very extensive depositions and what many of us think have been a failure to respond to the interrogatories as they should have been responded to. The interrogatories probably are among the most controversial features of the federal rules, and many lawyers, including myself, take a rather dim view of the way they're practiced in the federal court, and I would hope that could be corrected in some
way. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Strayer.
Just one short question, please, Attorney. Do you think it's feasible to pass a bill, something of this sort, that would require that having the rules been suggested that they be given approval by the next session of the legislature before they take effect, which would give some input? Since the bar is not unanimous on this and probably never will be, it's moving one way or another. It could well be that some people, majority would favor one rule and majority would not favor another rule. Is this a viable alternative to the black or white proposal we have before us?
I'm not too familiar with the provision of this particular bill, Senator White. I've read it, but I don't recall now. As I recall, it has an effective date in 1974.
Comes up back.
Is it subject to approval by the legislature or to veto by the legislature?
No.
The previous bill that was in the legislature, I believe, copied the provision in the Federal Act, which called for the Supreme Court to formulate the rules and to file them with the legislature, and they would become effective by a certain date unless the legislature vetoed them. Now, that is another possible approach that could be taken on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Strayer. There are 20 minutes allotted to the opponents, and there are six persons to testify. Bud Green.
Brewery.
I'll make it short, Madam Chairman, because I actually wasn't supposed to be first on this particular group. My name is Burl Green, and I'm a lawyer in Portland. I, too, have served on many of these practices. Procedure committees. I'm currently on the Judicial Administration Committee. I mention that only to point out that this subject was never brought up to the Oregon State Bar Committees in the year 1973, and no action has been taken by the bar in the year 1973. And I wish to point out that you are being asked to abdicate tremendous power to four people, the majority of the Supreme Court, without having any reservations whatsoever. That's more power than is given to the Supreme Court of the United States. Because if the Supreme Court wants to pass a rule, that has to be approved by Congress. And you're being asked to abdicate even that small power. I wish to point out that those in favor of this, as shown by the minutes of the House, obviously stem from Chief Justice O'Connell. And he had two delegates come over to that particular hearing and speak on his behalf. He did this, and it was done without any reference to the Oregon State Bar or any of its committees, without any reference to any judicial group, meaning the Judicial Conference. And the Judicial Conference in its executive session last Friday voted 5-1 to ask this committee not to have any more hearings on this or not to make any decisions, please, until they could speak among themselves and make the decision. They haven't even considered it. It hasn't been brought up. They've been bypassed. And that's all the judges of the state of Oregon. It bypassed the Judicial Commission, which is set up by this legislature just to discuss this very, very type of thing and make recommendations. Nothing was done as far as contacting them, completely bypassing them so they could not come back and make their recommendations to you. We ask at least that these people, these groups, be given the opportunity to look at this bill and present their views to you. Now, I would further point out, while I'm trying to answer every one of the arguments, and I'm sure others can answer better than I, that this isn't a simple matter. There are 56 volumes of the federal rules decision. And those are, as Senator Burns would know, those are large volumes. 56, just interpreting what the federal rules mean. What kind of a change is that going to make in the state of Oregon? Thank you very kindly.
Oh, just a minute, sir.
Oh, sorry.
Questions of Mr. Green? Thank you very much, Mr. Green. Francis Marsh.
My name is Francis Marsh, and I practice law at McMinn Mill with my twin brother Eugene Marsh, who some of you probably know. I have practiced in McMinn Mill since 1935. In September of this year, Gene will have practiced 50 acres, and so will I. We're twin brothers, and we were born on the same day. Now, this particular issue here, I feel that our past experience, at least at the time, would give us a little authority to speak for the small-town litigant. In Yamhill County, we are part of the 12th Judicial District, which is Polk and Yamhill County, and I can't see where these rules would help us there. Actually, we don't have any trouble trying cases and getting them tried over in Polk and Yamhill County. If you have good judges and you have a good bar, a lot of these issues or a lot of these troubles will disappear. Let me give you one example of what happened in our county when we got into the interrogatories as provided by the federal rules. This was a case that involved the purchase of a heifer. A man in near Newburgh bought a heifer, and it developed mange disease, and it destroyed the whole herd, and he sued the seller of the heifer for damage. We had to sue in the United States District Court, the Western District of Washington, in the federal court, and we came subject to the federal rules. Now, at the time the interrogatories were sent us, there was 274 questions to answer. We had to get the county to ask. We were suing for about $18,000 because it actually the herd had to be slaughtered, and there was about 50 or 60 nice Holstein cattle that had to be slaughtered because of this mange disease infection. If you could just take time to read these questions and read the answers, you would see that this opens the door to harassment. Let me just give you an example, just one or two questions. One of the questions was number 176. List and identify the number of other animals and poultry which were kept on said farm during the period of 1950 through 1958. What that had to do with a bunch of cattle being subjected to Fang's disease? Well, the answer was, from 1950 to 1952, approximately 20 hens and a rooster, that's what we had, one saddle pony, one dog, and several cats, plus the dairy stock. From 1952 to the present, approximately 25 chickens and a rooster, three or four geese, one dog, later two dogs, and several cats, plus the dairy herd. Now look at the question that we had over here on question 186. Were there any other cows other than Chimicum Hazelwood Bell, and that was the infected heifer, tearing calves on May 10, 1955? If the answer to the interrogatory number 185 is yes, please identify said pregnant cows and indicate the length of time each such cow had been carrying a calf. Well, it took us about three pages in here to list them all. And to figure that out, we had to have a computer.
Did you have names for each of them?
Yeah, we had them. We got a name. Even I found my wife's name among the bunch. Now, there was May, Kay, Happy, Suzanne, Kathleen, Hazelette, Margaret, Betty. Now, let's get down to the one that's kind of the jawbreaker. Question 240. During the period from 1950 through 1955, did any of the bulls on the said farm suffer from lack of sexual desire or infertility? Well, we went out and the bull told us it wasn't any of our business. Now, this is about how silly these things get. And Manuel Frey will say that these interrogatories are a bunch of bunk. You can kill a client dead. Why, this man, he settled for $6,000. He had an $18,000 claim. They bully wagged us around, so, well, he was a little fellow from Netherlands. He'd never been Isaac Brock, and he had a dairy herd, and it ruined him. By the time the lawyer in Seattle took a bite out of him, and the time that I took a bite of him, and I might say I charged him $250 for work, it would have run $5,000 if I'd have charged him for all the time. You cannot subject a small litigant to this kind of business, and that's all, unless you want to. It's just like you can't afford to be sick anymore. The average person can't afford a lawyer anymore. You can't afford litigation if you're going to make it tough. Now, in Yamhill County and in Polk County, and Bruce Pauling is here, he can tell you about this, we never have any trouble getting cases tried. The courts would set about 15 a month, and we would try them one right after another. Because lawyers that are busy, they know they can't make money unless they're kept busy, unless they're trying cases. And if they're trial lawyers, that's the only way they can make money. Now, I think that to adopt rules where you can be subject litigants in cities like McMinnville or counties like Yamhill and Polk County and other counties throughout the state is a detriment to the litigant. It doesn't hurt the lawyer. The lawyer makes money out of it. But the person that's in the lawsuit, the guy that's paying the bill, is the fellow that's going to get hurt.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh. We have questions of Mr. Marsh. Thank you very much, sir. The next name, is it Hibbard, George Hibbard?
Madam Chairman, gentlemen, my name is George Hibbard. I'm a practicing lawyer in Oregon City. I appear here just as an interested lawyer and also an interest with an axe to grind in behalf of my law firm and partners in it who are active trial lawyers. I'd like to present to the committee a letter in opposition to this bill from the Oregon chapter of the American Board of Trial Advocates, a letter from a Mr. David C. Landis, a former law clerk on the Oregon Supreme Court, from the standpoint of his his experience as a law clerk under the rules of Oregon, and the letter with numbers of copies from the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. I speak a little bit from some experience as an active attorney in the affairs of the bar over the past years. This matter has been before the bar for, within my experience and knowledge, quite spasmodically and intermittently since about 1959. Manley Strayer is correct that a vote was taken in 1962. He is almost correct in the number of votes. That poll of the bar resulted in 670 votes for, 565 votes against, and 120 people indicated that they wished more information on the subject matter before they could make up their mind. It seems to me that it's clear from listening to the people both pro and con here today, and I don't believe anything that's coming will change that, that you can only conclude that within the bench and the bar, who are the people that have to work with these things and probably have the greatest interest in seeing that we do have a workable system, is a great and strong disagreement, and it is a controversial matter. I simply wish to put in a plea here today that this legislation not be passed at this time, that an opportunity be given for, as I understand, a forthcoming consideration of it will occur shortly among the association that the bench has in the state, and that the bar itself have an opportunity to actually speak on this subject matter through the vote of its members. One problem with polling the membership of the bar on a question like this is indicated from the total of 1,355 votes that resulted from the prior poll. The bar has an excess of 3,000 members, so you don't get the true attitude of all the members of the bar, and I suppose you can say that all you get is the attitude of those who are interested in the subject matter, but you don't know whether those that express their interest have an extensive trial practice or not. The fear among the members of the bar and of those that are opposed to it is that federal rules will be adopted. And the history of this thing throughout the nation is that's exactly what has happened. And from the experience of Oregon lawyers, it's a time waster and it's an expensive thing beyond what the litigants of the state can really assume and take upon themselves. I think that the Oregon system works well, and in spite of Mr. Salstrom's complaints about pleading technicalities, that is something that the legislature could change if it wished to. I simply wish to express a desire that both of these legal bodies have an opportunity to make a definitive study and presentation to the legislature if that's required. And let the legislature be wary of relinquishing the power that it now has to a body of people who, as all bodies of people who work maybe kind of narrow, don't always have the answers to the subject matters that they're working with.
Thank you, Mr. Hibbert. Senator White.
I'm sorry to say this, but somehow or another, when you say, and that the letters you've submitted here say the same thing, this ought to be studied by certain committees or what, kind of taxes my patience. This thing wasn't submitted for the first time in the last 12 months. And in any other area of controversy, I'd have to be honest and call it a stall.
Well, I think your criticism is valid. I think Senator Burns' criticism that he's disappointed in the leadership of the bar is valid. That doesn't take away from the picture of the fact, however, that it's an area of wide disagreement. And that it is something that is the present system is working, and the state and the legislature ought to be careful before it relinquishes the power it now has.
I'd just like to pursue this for a minute. I'm sorry to take the time. Sir, I think you're still, not to you, but what you're saying sounds like a stall. In other words, what assurance does anybody have that we'll know any more in 2 years from now than we do right now?
Well, I'm certain that if you, as a senatorial committee, feel that this is a subject matter of sufficient consequence that you wish something on it, a memorial from you, as you frequently do to other bodies in the state, that by the next legislature you want an answer one way or another on this with adequate representation studies behind it, that it would be honored.
I can only respond by being sarcastic. To moralize the state bar was something like something that I never heard of before.
Well, other things that I haven't heard of before, and I do sincerely think that if that happened, you would find that you would have an excellent study presented to you.
Thank you, Mr. Hibbert. Pat Hurley?
My name is Pat Hurley, and I'm in practice in Portland, essentially in the trial practice. And rather than talk to you hypothetically or theoretically about the differences that exist, and I thought I'd bring with me some demonstrative indications of the difference between the trial of two almost identical cases, one in state court and one in federal court. A couple of years ago, two businesses failed, and in essence, the creditors sued the three directors of each corporation, claiming that if they'd been minding their business, that the corporation would have prospered and the creditors wouldn't have been stuck. One case was filed in state court, and I defended the three directors. That case went through completely to trial within a period of a couple of months. This is the entire file of that case. It weighs 8 ounces. I charged each of the three defendants $200, a total of $600. Now, an identical case that is presently pending in federal court has this as only the pleading file. I've got another file I call the garbage file that's got to be that high. This case hasn't been tried yet, and it's a year and a half old. And the three corporate directors in that case are out $6,000.
Questions, Mr. Hurley?
Thank you, Mr. Drill. Mr. Morrison? W. H. Morrison, practicing in Portland since 1924. And I want to say that this particular bill has never been submitted here before. The one in 1959 was defeated. And correct me on the supplement, Mr. Strayer said this was fully argued before the bar Tuesday, and the bar voted against it after the refrain, and it's fully argued. And Mr. Strayer and I participated in that debate to both oppose each other. Now, I had the privilege of being on the American Bar Committee. That was for the purpose of coming up with some solutions to this terrific court congestion and to improve the freedom of trial practice throughout the United States, and particularly emphasis on this congestion where some cities are 5 years behind in the trial. And I came away from that sitting on that convinced that Oregon has the finest procedure in the United States. You've been stated here that far quick cases go on to trial. So they're filed in Multnomah County in February. They're being tried now, civil cases, and about 40 days criminal cases. You go up to Seattle where they have these rules, a great number of judges, and there, they are 1 year behind. You go to San Francisco, 30 months behind. And Los Angeles, over 30 months behind. And in all those cases, in San Francisco and Los Angeles and wherever they have these rules, they use the hammer on them. They take them in there, they're so congested. And the trial practice, they get the clients in there and force them to settle during the trial of the case. And the litigant goes away mumbling, what kind of justice is that? Now that's being done in every place where they have these federal rules. Now there's in the Supreme Court, in the United States Supreme Court, that has the rulemaking power. But it must be approved by Congress. And that is so unsatisfactory. And the federal courts are so congested at the present time, which I believe mostly by reason of these terrible interrogatories that the court. Even Mr. Strayer feels that they're bad. And they have them wherever they have these federal rules. That there is a bill now before Congress to divest the federal courts and take about 40% of the cases away from the federal court and put in the state court. Now that has the approval of the United States Supreme Court, has approval of the American Bar Committees, and I'm sure it's going through to take about 40% of the cases out of the federal court, and it's due to the fact that this terrific congestion. Mr. Fair is not for all of it. He wants this class action. That's the United States rule. That gives the little fellow a chance to harass the big boys a little bit. But this thing here, the ordinary man sue some big corporation, they can break it if he's just suing for $10,000 or $20,000. Justice Tongue said they passed on cases in the Supreme Court involving $2,000 and $3,000. You can't try one in the federal court for that. And your litigant comes in with you. He comes in with this pleading. It tells you that it's just a notice pleading. It's the suing you. You can't tell him what that's going to cost him to defend this thing. They start right in that taking interrogatories, reams of them. And you can't tell them what the issues are. Then they have a pretrial order after they get all these things taken, and that's what it's tried on. You have no idea what it's going to charge you. Now he said these people, Professor Newton, who hasn't been admitted to practice in Oregon, very amusing, telling about how antiquated this is. Now this pleading that they say is so modern, this notice pleading, if they had searched the buffet, they'd find it's the most primitive pleading in England, where we got our common law pleading. And it was discarded in England in 1500, the same kind of pleading that they put in here in the federal rules. You don't hear them mention that. It was discarded. First, in those, before 1500, in England, if you want to sue somebody, you said a little writ, you're going to sue it. And just they weren't called barristers.
If you could finish up, we have others that these senators have to be elsewhere, sir. Questions, Mr. Morris?
Yeah, what are they doing in England now?
Well, now, of course, they have their common law pleading. But at that time, they just had these little writs, and the judge would write up the pleading.
I'm serious. Well, is the pleading in England more similar to Oregon's or more similar to what's being proposed here?
Well, they're modernizing their pleading. They don't have the old. They don't win as much as they commonly. It's more of a Oregon, you know, is a plain, concise statement of what the facts are, and it's not difficult. We have three young fellows in our office who came in last fall. They don't find these pleadings, and I'm sure, Mr. Cook, you don't find them difficult.
Thank you. Bruce Balding.
I'm Bruce Balding. I practice law in Portland, and I used to practice law in Salem, and before that I practiced law in Dallas, so I have had a somewhat of a wider area of experience than most lawyers, and I have had a considerable experience as in the trial of cases, both in the federal court, under the federal system, and under the state system. And it just isn't true that accurate is a better word, I expect, that you can practice under these federal rules with all these interrogatories and all that goes with it without being given any definite advice in your pleading complaint what this case is about. And then you can, for less money in the state court and less time. The reason why these interrogatories, and I think that's one of the worst parts of these federal rules, and why Mr. Strayer, and I don't blame him because I've been through some of the same cases he has and some of the same travail, is that I, on one side, can ask a whole lot of questions. I've got a file of this full of interrogatories in a particular kind of a case, in a malpractice case. As soon as that comes in, it's much cheaper for me to just give them the works, all these couple hundred questions, and than it is for me to go through there and pick out what is material and what I need to know. I can do it cheaper and save my client money by making the other fellow pay the freight of digging through a lot of stuff that doesn't help either side. And my duty is to save my client what money I can. Now, the question that has been raised here several times, couldn't the legislature, if it does abandon its rulemaking power or by statute to the Supreme Court, couldn't it back out by amending a rule? Sure it could, which would amount to repealing what is being proposed now be enacted. And that's the only way. Once you get the power in the Supreme Court, it's kind of hard to get away. In the interest of time, I won't go on. I think that...
Thank you, sir. Questions of Mr. Spaulding?
I'd like to ask Mr. Spaulding, Chairman. Bruce, by any chance, is there any practical way of having the Supreme Court submit rules to the legislature and have it require their approval before they take effect? Would this be a practical alternative?
I would think that would not be impossible.
Well, is it a viable one?
It wouldn't seem to me that it would save any...
You're talking about a couple 300,000 rules. I realize it wouldn't be, but it sounds like that some people are complaining about a few horrible
well,
example
what
rules.
What it would amount to, I suppose, is the legislature appointing the Supreme Court as a committee to act like in the place of our commission we had for the criminal law revision. And they'd be a pretty good committee.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Spaulding. Well, Judge Lewis, would you turn to Senate Bill 10 and the other book?
I'll leave it. I
just want to hear it.
I don't have to do that. I think 20 minutes. I'm supposed to do a conference.
What was that number again, Joe?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Judge Lewis, I apologize for keeping you waiting so long.
Perfectly all right, Senator. I have been down here on a late Friday afternoon and a beautiful May afternoon, and I know you all want to be out of that.
Madam Chairman, maybe Judge Lewis, who I think was chairman of one of those committees, for whom some of the same cast characters testified, could give us a little bit of history. No.
I remember those. They were interesting. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Gene L. Lewis. I'm a circuit judge in Multnomah County. I'm here on behalf of Senate Bill 10. First, I'd like to say that I am not at war with the Children's Services Division. I am not angry at or disappointed. Well, I am a little disappointed but I am not here to criticize the Children's Services Division, the Department of Human Resources, or any of their personnel. But we have in our state, I think, a situation that needs legislative help. ORS 418015 requires that when the Children's Services Division shall accept a child submitted to it and shall provide such services for the child as the division finds to be necessary. That was amended by 20-year bill, Senator Burns, in 1971. It's a good change in the law. ORS 419507 gives a committing court having juvenile jurisdiction certain authority with respect to children. Subsection 1 authorizes us to put the child on probation, to take him into protective custody, to put him in a youth care center or a child care center or anything else if we have the money to pay the bill. We don't. R2, we may place the child in the legal custody of the Children's Services Division for care, placement, and supervision. Subsection B then provides, and I quote, to ensure effective planning for children, the Children's Services Division shall take into consideration recommendations and information provided by the committing court. They shall take into consideration. The Court of Appeals just a few weeks ago in the Richardson case affirmed Judge Lennon of our county, who had refused to intervene in a quarrel between the parents of the child and the CSC caseworker, who would not permit the parents to see the child. Judge Lennon ruled under ORS 419507 sub 2, once we commit to CSC, we have no control of the child. And the Court of Appeals affirmed that decision. Now, what does this mean? It means that I have little guys in lockup for 400 days, which is inexcusable and intolerable. I had one little kid for 219 days. I was asked to hold him until he was 12 until he could go to McLaren. We cannot tolerate that to continue in Oregon.
Can I interrupt? These children that you're talking about that were being held for so long, was that because you did not want to commit them to Children's Services or because you did?
We had committed to Children's Services. One was permanently committed. He had no, and I believe on that child, the only way we ever moved him, I hired a lawyer. The lawyer brought mandamus against the governor, the state treasurer, the director of human resources, and anybody else who could think of. And it's only after a petition for writ of mandamus were we able to find a placement for that child. That child had been in detention for 219 days. That child has no parents. That child is a permanent ward of the state. Now, these are the kids that worry me. I intend to appear before Ways and Means and do anything within my power to help Children's Services get money to provide services for children. But what happens as a practical matter is this. I think about 80% of the kids coming to the courts are there because of need for protection, not because they've done delinquent acts. We commit a child to CSC, so our counselors aren't too much involved with it. CSC knows that the child is safe. They have limited resources. Some of these kids we're talking about are seriously sick little boys, and there aren't facilities in our state. The Child Study and Treatment section of CSC is trying to find facilities. They're doing a good job. I don't want to criticize them at all. But the little guys hang up under my lock and key for far too long. Some children have been there 60 days, 90 days, 120 days. We have review hearings. I think you probably have, Senator Brown, some of the transcripts of some of the hearings.
Yes, ma'am.
Where at one level, it's not within my competence, I have to go to my supervisor. The supervisor has to go to the director. The director has to go to the district director. Then it goes to another program. Then this program finds something, but you have to go to the foster care program to get money. And the little guy sits there hour after hour after hour. What Senate bill hopefully would do would require Children's Services to come up with a plan, and then once they had a plan, to implement the plan. Now, in view of the limited control of the courts, this then gives the courts some control. I don't want to sue Children's Services. I don't want to fight anybody in that organization for contempt. I want to file mandamus to hire attorneys. I want to provide care for kids. I want people within this state to sit down and think together. We have a problem. We have a child in need of care. Let's implement this plan.
What would you fill in the blank here, Jim?
Whatever is reasonable, 14 days, 15 days, 20 days.
What do you think would be a reasonable time?
Well, I think 14 or 15 days is about the period nationally that is considered the maximum time a child ought to stay in detention. You see, a detention unit is only designed as a short-term holding facility, a protective facility to protect kids from their parents while you work out some kind of program. I don't want to impose any unnecessary hardship on any agency, but it would seem to me 14 or 15 days, which is a national standard, is reasonable.
Senator Johnson.
Judge Lewis, what's the ORSI number that you gave us? What is it?
418-015, which makes it mandatory for Children's Services to accept.
418-015.
Sub 2.
And
the section then that the Court of Appeals construed in Richardson is 419-507-2D.
Well, now, if I understand that correctly, it said that once the court had committed a child to Children's Services, that the court no longer had jurisdiction, or just like the adult correction statute, which says when a prisoner is delivered to the executive head of the institution, the court.
This has always been true at the Foreign and Health Institution, too.
But it hasn't been true in foster care, youth care. Well, you know, that wasn't my intention in connection with the passage of the bill that set up the Children's Services Division, and I've been distressed. I was distressed after German last session when the people at the juvenile court told me that that was one of the effective parts of the act. But do I understand you to say that this Senate Bill 10 would not completely repeal that?
It doesn't repeal it. It just gives us authority to do something with regard to youngsters who are in need of care or treatment.
Does it give you continuing authority like you had prior to the...
I don't think it does. I don't think it goes far enough. But I think you have problems with CSC, and I know that they have some personnel here who will tell you that federal funds can't come in if the state or the courts have any strings to federal money. Now they tell us $11 million of federal money isn't going to be available, so why not give the courts some power? What happens if you get a situation where a CSD worker and a parent come to the loggerhead, and the parents can't see the child, as in the Richardson case? There's no way that those parents can see that child. There's nothing the court can do to help them. We can vacate the commitment to CSD, and then what do we do with the child? I could unload every one of those youngsters in detention now and take them up to the CSD office and say they're committed to you. They're your responsibility. But you can't do that to children.
Well, is there a proposal to go further with respect to undoing what was done on as far as the court authority? Is there another bill that goes a little bit further than this?
I haven't seen all the amendments.
I don't know unless it's in 2050, and I understand they've deleted the first 16 sections of 2050.
I'm not sure what all is left in 2050.
Perhaps John could look it up. Okay, thank you.
Senator Smith.
What are the detention facilities like?
It's a miniature jail, frankly. In Multnomah County, we have 3 boys units and 3 girls units. We have a school. The kids each have their own room. We have certain periods of the day where they can go off to play. We call upon a number of volunteers who will take them swimming, those that are not security ready. We try to get tickets for them from various places.
Maximum security?
Yes, and then there are isolation rooms where there's nearly a top on the floor because we have some very destructive children. Self-destructive as well.
Well, is it possible that we're better off in detention than it would be with children's services?
these are children who can't be returned home. Therefore, the court has committed them to Children's Services Division. Some of these are kids who have been committed to Children's Services Division, have been in foster care, and have run away. So they're brought back to us. We'll see if he looks for another home. Some of them are children who are persistent runaways. They are little rabbits. You can't trust them for a minute. They speak. Some of them are emotionally sick little guys that eat glass. They think nobody can hurt them. They can walk in front of cars. They have no feeling of guilt. I don't know if this is one of the transcripts we sent down, but a psychiatrist testified, you take a baby and put a patch over its eye and leave it there for a year or two. At the end of 2 years, the child can't see, although the eye is perfectly good. Children who have never known a bit of blood, a bit of mothering from birth, never are able to accept mother. Therefore, they can't go into the normal foster home situation where mothering and fathering is an important element of rehabilitation. But most of our youngsters, we have a policy in our court now where every day I go through the detention list, and if any child is there more than 2 months, I start screening. I hope someday to cut it down to 30 days. On the last group of children at the court that I looked at, over 60% of those that have been held for more than a week were all committed to CSC and were being held for them. Well, the problem is more complicated than that. If CSC commits a child, say, to St. Mary's Home for Boys, CSC pays St. Mary's Home for Boys for that child. If the child runs away and comes to detention, we don't get paid. This is all up to the county, every county that holds. If the child is in foster care and needs hospitalization or medical care, there are funds available to pay it. If the child is in detention, there are no funds to pay it. I have one 17-year-old boy whose teeth are almost rotted at the gum line. He's been in foster care for 15 years. A treatment program finally began for him last fall. The foster parents died. He had to be moved. He couldn't accept the new movement and ended back in the court. His dental care stopped because he's in detention. Now, we have to devise something that's going to stop this kind of nonsense. I'm sorry, gentlemen, from CSC. I like you. You're nice guys, but I won't tolerate it much longer.
Well, Madam Chairman, this same question the Interim Committee on the Juvenile Code wrestled with, and I call it kids falling in between the cracks. This bill is a Band-Aid, isn't it, Gene, really?
It is a Band-Aid.
And I don't think we ought to settle for a Band-Aid.
I'd rather have a Band-Aid than let the blood drip.
Well, I don't blame you, but what I'm trying to say is, somehow or another, I just can't stand for just using the Band-Aid on this critical problem. And I don't know whether we have a bill or whether we have the facilities to develop number 10 or whether we got something else. As I say, I sweated and bled over and cried over this for 2 years, and I wasn't too well satisfied, and I guess nothing's come out of that other business, so I think this committee's got to take the bull by the horns.
I think you can do it by looking at 419507 2D and changes to ensure effective planning that they take into consideration recommendations, provide some sort of authority for the court. CSC must submit a plan, and the plan must be approved by the court. And then I think it's done. Which is part of Betty's bill. Thank you, Betty, for your meeting.
Yes.
I have another question.
Senator John Burns.
Now, as long as...
What's the other bill? What other bill is she talking about?
You know, I get a lot of undercurrent, and somebody who has worked for the court in Multnomah County, the Longhorn, said that under the establishment of CSD, Children's Services Division runs the Longhorn now, as opposed to...
What are your plans on that Supreme Court rulemaking thing? Are you going to bring it up again, or just have a work session?
The way it used to be,
I don't plan to hold
the court.
There isn't anything more you want.
No. Yes, but I don't want to hear it.
Can you not go
again? No. When do you plan on bringing it up in the work session? How much more time?
It almost has
in
time.
A week or so.
On dependency
cases. That's fine,
thanks. Because we don't have any authority in planning. Our workers are told, what have you got to say? We have the money. And we want to work cooperatively because two heads are better than one sometimes.
Right.
and a court counselor might have an idea that somebody else hasn't thought about. Why not share the knowledge and work together?
Senator Kirk.
Would you have time, Judge, to prepare for us in the next couple of 3 days a bill like an appointment ought to be the way things ought to be?
Why?
It's going to be more than just this. It's going to be more than just more than a Band-Aid. That's what we're talking about now, isn't it?
Why don't you prepare a bill the way you think it ought to be and try to get it down
here? Senator Iverson.
Well, Gene, of course, I'm distressed by what I hear, and I don't want to prejudge without hearing the other side, but I sure never have any intention of allowing the Children's Service Division to decide that they're the supreme being, and that the court, to me, the court should have the final say. And I would hope that you would come up with a plan that would allow the court to retain jurisdiction. Why can't you now, even without this bill, and of course I realize we're hamstrung by all the federal regulations on money, but could you not commit the child, say, for 15 days, and then come bring it back to the court with a plan?
This is what we did, and this is why we had these review hearings. But where is the child held or
moved? Well, I mean, this is what we should work out, where they have to pay, no matter where that child is. It's in the jurisdiction for the...
Particularly medical care.
It's the taxpayer's money, and why the Children's Service Division, unless it's in the law, it may not be their fault, I don't know.
It's in the federal regulation. I don't think it's their fault. I think...
That's why I don't want to prejudge them without hearing, because there may be some reason why
they
can't.
They agree that they have a moral responsibility, but they're hamstrung by these crazy federal regulations.
For every rule, it seems like there's a way you can get around it if you really try.
You're a lawyer, George. You ought to know that.
Well, Dick, I've learned from you.
Did you read the transcript? Yes, I have.
Can you see what I'm talking about?
Yes, I sure do.
We had this one little kid, the CSD did a wonderful job in Portland. They set up a child advocacy committee up at the medical school. And they called upon the people in the child training treatment center who were specialists in these hard to place kids, the people in the Department of Psychiatry, the Department of Pediatrics, and at any agency that's ever dealt with this child, and they get together, they call it staffing in the social work field, to see what this little guy needs and what facilities there are and how we can really help this little guy. This is the sort of thing I'd like to see done in every case, maybe not that elaborate, but to come up with a plan that is going to provide treatment. And I know, I don't mean to be critical of CSD, I honestly think they're trying. They suddenly inherited thousands of headaches all over this city, and they're getting worse all the time.
Well, I think one of the points that should be made is a lot of these kids are subject to neglect by the state. They'd be taken from their own parents if they were neglected in that fashion.
But a detention, every study that ever has come out on detention facilities clearly says this is a short-term holding facility. All it should be designed for.
Further questions? Thank you for coming down.
Could I put in one word
sure.
on one other bill?
Okay.
I don't know if you get that.
Sorry.
No, I don't care. No, it was brought to my attention today at a group of nurses that in the bill that we passed last session to require the reporting of child abuse, that you refer to physicians, and this includes an intern. And lots of times, the person who gets the most information about the child is a nurse. You know, when you're feeding them, and this is the person really, the nurses aren't in it now.
Well, is that 2101?
There is a bill, I understand, that has passed, but it doesn't need the House. And it's in the Senate, maybe I'm assuming it. There is one other thing, and I apologize to you all. This bill also has passed the House, and we are denying due process of law to many people in our state. A divorce is a privilege. You can't get a divorce unless you go to court and do it. Poor people who don't know where their spouses are can't afford the public. I think this is a complete denial of due process. In Multnomah County, we pay the cost of publication for them. and this is a rather expensive item. There is a bill that authorizes posting, mailing to the last known address and the like. And this would make it possible. The court will, of course, have to look and see whether or not there's been due diligence. I think it's for your committee, Dave.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
It's patterned after several other comparable legislation in other states, but it is, I think, a complete denial of due process to say to a poor person, you can't get a divorce if you don't come up with a publication card.
Stick around, if you can get me a couple more votes, I'll get that bill out.
What's your bill? I didn't know that.
The other people, being mostly from Salem, except Mr. Williams, will hear them again. Thank you.
Thank you.